This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bean Cooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Seth Meyers, is having a good year. In February, he became host of NBC's Late Night, and it was just announced Meyers will be hosting the Primetime Emmys later this summer. Meyers replaced Jimmy Fallon on Late Night when Fallon made the move to The Tonight Show. Meyers and Fallon worked together on Saturday Night Live. Seth Meyers joined the cast of SNL in 2001, later becoming head writer and anchor of Weekend Update. SNL was his dream job, but Lorne Michaels, executive producer of Saturday Night Live, Late Night, and now The Tonight Show, encouraged Meyers to move on to the 12:30 show and make it his own. Terry spoke with Meyers last Wednesday and began with a clip from the opening of the first Seth Meyers edition of Late Night on February 24th. It's an homage to Jimmy Fallon's regular feature on Late Night, Thank You Notes.
Thank you, Jimmy Fallon, for taking over The Tonight Show at 11:30 so I could take over Late Night at 12:30. I promise to treat it with respect and dignity and to only use it to do completely original comedy pieces. Starting now.
Seth Meyers, welcome to Fresh Air. That was such a great way of kicking off the Seth Meyers Late Night.
Yes, it was a very nice idea by our head writer, Alex Bays. I was very relieved that we came up with something like that.
Now, I read in an interview with you that one of the reasons why you left SNL for Late Night is that you wanted a saner life. Having a daily hour-long show as offering a saner life struck me as one of the most delusional things I've ever heard in my life.
I'm so happy to say that 7 weeks in, I think I was right.
Really?
I could have very possibly been delusional, but this new schedule, unlike SNL, every day at SNL is wildly different. Like, Mondays are so different than Wednesdays, and the whole week is sort of this tea kettle boiling with the release coming, obviously Saturday at 11:30, and everyone who works there feels like they're to some degree inside this tea kettle, and that pressure really gets to you and I think wears you down, and everybody who works at SNL looks like 10 years older than they are. the makeup hides that come Saturday, but trust me, if you see us at Tuesday night in the hallway, it's a bunch of ghosts and zombies. So this new job, because you get the release of doing a show every night, as well as the fact that, you know, we're not doing the show at 12:30, we're doing the show at 6:30. You finish the show. I actually am getting home at like 8:30 or 9 o'clock, which is a fairly human time to walk in the door. And I found the schedule, a lot more amenable to having a healthier existence.
So let's talk about figuring out what your version of Late Night would be. One of the things you actually had to figure out was how to walk out.
You can't believe how hard that is.
No, I can believe it.
Yeah. The funny thing is, you know, they have to put a mark on the floor where you're supposed to end up every night. And just the stress of hitting that mark, I think the whole first week, I couldn't even bear to watch myself walk out because I felt like I would look like an insane person, like just like staring at a spot on the floor. Also,
you have to be on that spot on the floor so that the camera gets you just right and the lighting gets you just
right.
Yeah,
that's where the spot is. You know, that's where the lighting is sort of optimal. And so that is a very, for me, unnatural thing. You know, I've done stand-up for a long time, but even in stand-up, the main difference is holding a microphone.
Mm-hmm.
The trickiest part of this job the first week was just figuring out what to do with my hands.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the great discoveries I made at the show was the memory of pockets. I was like, okay, I can put one of these away. I, as a person in conversation, tend to use my hands a great deal. And I think my first couple of monologues, I looked like someone on a desert island trying to signal for a plane, a passing plane. And, you know, it's weird. A few people said, a friend even after the first couple of shows, like, you seemed a little nervous the first night, to which I replied, yeah, I was a little nervous. That's why. Well, you nailed it.
You'd be crazy if you weren't nervous.
You would be crazy. Yeah.
So, you know, on Weekend Update, you were sitting behind a desk, so you didn't really have to worry about, you know, walking out there or standing or using your hands. Those desks are really protective. So did you consider doing your opening monologue from a desk?
Well, I wanted to be different than Weekend Update. I didn't want it to be just this straight transition. And because I do like standing and telling jokes as well, mm-hmm. you know, I feel like I was really lucky to have done things like host the ESPYs on ESPN and do the White House Correspondents' Dinner and do stand-up. And so I've had sort of...
But you had a podium for the White House dinner, didn't you?
I did have a podium for the White House. one that I imagine if you checked, you'd still see my grip marks in the wood. But, I enjoy the idea, at least, of transitioning to standing and knowing that, you know, 85-90% of the show is still going to be sitting behind a desk. So, but there is something nice about doing a monologue, and that was a thing... As so certainly when we were doing our hiring as well, we wanted the show to have a really strong monologue. We thought it was something people liked. We liked the idea of it. We thought we could get really good joke writers. And one of the nice developments, I think, over the first 7 weeks was the idea that, unlike Weekend Update, when you tell a joke that doesn't get the reaction you thought it would get or expecting it to get, you sort of move on to the next joke. There's not a lot of room to play around in Weekend Update. You're in a much smaller box just with the framing of the shot. And... it's been nice to sort of understand and get to learn that the monologue is, a lot of it is how good the jokes are, but a lot of it too is having fun with those jokes and sort of making it a bit of a performance piece instead of just a delivery of jokes.
So one of the regular things that you do is you tell a story after the opening monologue.
Yeah.
And I'm gonna play one of my favorites, and this is from like, early in the show, like it was the first week, but I'll just play the story and then we'll talk about it. So this is Seth Meyers from the first week of Late Night.
One of my favorite things about getting to stay in this building, getting to stay in New York, is I love interactions with strangers in New York. I had a great one the other day. I was in a restaurant and I had gone to the bathroom and I walked out of the bathroom and there was just a woman standing there. And she grabbed me by the arm and she goes, "It's my son's birthday. He's a huge fan. Will you come take a picture with him?" And I said, "Of course I will." And so she's walking over, and I guess shame on me, but I thought because of the way she was talking, we were talking like a 12 or 13-year-old kid. And I get to the table, and he's 25. He's like a young man. And the look on his face, he was so bummed out. Like, the look on his face was not like, "Oh, my God, Seth Meyers." It was like, "Oh, my God, Mom, what did you do?" And it was my nightmare because he was in the center of a booth. And I was like, "Well, I'll just slide in on the end and you can take the picture." She's like, "No, you have to be next to the birthday boy." He was not psyched to be called the birthday boy. So everybody had to get out of the booth and I had to go sit next to him. And it was like he was mad at me. He was like, "Oh, hey, how are you?" And I felt bad for him, but part of me wanted to be like, "So what do you want to be when you grow up?" And so they were sitting there, and, like, everybody had to get out, everybody had to get back in. I'm sitting with him, and then the mom takes the picture. And in, like, the history of, like, moms and cell phone cameras, like, they'd never nail the first picture. Like, she, like, took it and then looked at it and was like, "I didn't get anyone." She definitely pointed it at us. So finally take it, and I got out, and he was never happy at all, any of it. And so I got up and I left, and he said something to her under his breath, and I didn't hear what he said, but I did hear what she said, because she said it very loudly for the whole restaurant to hear what she said. "Well, I am sorry, but I'm your mother." So I'd just like to say to that guy, happy birthday, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry about that bummer of a moment.
That's Seth Meyers hosting Late Night. That's such a great story.
Thank you.
When somebody asks you to take a picture with them, whether it's a selfie with them or somebody else taking the picture, do you ever say no? And if you say no, are you afraid that people will tweet that you are a cold and selfish egomaniac?
It's an excellent question. I will say, if anyone's listening, I so prefer a selfie. Once somebody hands their phone to a stranger, oftentimes I find, too, that people will hand the phone to the oldest person nearby who have not come to terms with this new technological advancement. So a selfie is fast. You can knock that out pretty quickly. My other pet peeve is when there's a group of people who want a picture and someone says, "Just one more," because as if they're speaking for the group, because it's probably not the last one. But there were two people at SNL that I always remember at times like that, Derek Jeter being one and Paul McCartney being the other, who more than anyone else, I felt like everybody at SNL, from the crew to the cast to guests of the show, had something they wanted to tell them, like some moment of their career that had so affected this person. And both Derek Jeter and Paul McCartney made so much time for everybody that had wanted it. And I always remember any time I don't take a picture with someone, I'm saying I'm a bigger deal than Paul McCartney and Derek Jeter. So I try to take them as every time.
Do you miss Saturday Night Live?
I do. I miss it a little bit less every day, which is nice. The thing I was so worried about leaving SNL was just the family and the routine and all of the wonderful people that I got to spend so much time with. And obviously, as you build your a new show like we have, you find that there are other really lovely people that you get to sort of build a new family with. So that's been great. I do miss the rush of SNL. And on Saturday at 11:30, when I'm sitting at home, I feel like phantom limbs, if that's the right expression, of just wanting to be out there. So that I certainly miss.
Do you watch it, or is it too painful to watch?
I watched the first one live, which was a real I felt the way I bet.
You mean live, Jeff, like in the studio?
Live at home. No, live at home, I should say. And let me just say, as a viewer, there are too many commercials.
I never knew that.
The other side, I never knew. Or I'd known as a child and then forgotten. But I felt like just this awful metamorphosis of no longer being on the show. The part you miss the most, not being on the show anymore, is Wednesday, which was the table read where you basically get to watch 40 pieces, all with varying degrees of success. But I remember when people like Kristen Wiig left or people like Andy Samberg left, the thing that I felt, you know, so lucky about was that I got to see everything they tried to do for a 7 or 8 year period, like all their failures, all their successes. You got to see everything, like in the incubator stage to the final product. And it's so, that part of the job is so wonderful.
What is the job of head writer?
Well, the job of head writer is basically just helping facilitate the writing staff and the cast to get the best stuff out every week. And by that, you know, you run a rewrite table once you pick the sketches that, you know, if you pick sort of 10 of the 40 that get produced on Tuesday night and you do a read through on Wednesday, you pick about 10. And there's two head writers who have rewrite tables, and you just try to make everything a little bit better. You try to take notes from Lorne and pass them on to the writing staff. The other job of the head writer is just to sort of look, always be looking at the landscape of the show and seeing what's missing. Oftentimes the last pieces that are filled in are the monologue for the host or the cold open, you know, the political cold open at the start of the show. Weekend Update features, which are the guests that come on Weekend Update. Those are the things that sort of break later in the week. So, you know, that's really the job. But a head writer is as good as the writing staff and the cast, who are all wonderful writers as well.
When a guest host comes on, what's the process like of deciding how to show off the guest host in the monologue?
Well, it's very interesting. If it's a guest host, you know. If it's someone who's coming back, if it's a Ben Affleck, if it's an Alec Baldwin, if you already sort of know their toolkit as far as their comedy chops go, then people often tend to try to write a monologue on a Tuesday night so you can hear it on Wednesday. With other people who are there for the sort of the first time, what sometimes happens is you want to wait and hear them on Wednesday. You get to listen to them read like 40 different pieces, and that will give you a better sense of who they are and sort of what they can pull off. But it's a very strange thing, because a lot of times people host the show and the one thing that they're not great at is being themselves. You know, that's certainly true of the best actors. Whereas, you know, obviously when you have somebody like Louis C.K., and it's time for the monologue, you just blissfully get out of the way and know that he'll do all the work and it'll be as good as a monologue could possibly be. So it can be really tricky. And, you know, there are times where it just makes sense to have someone sing because they're an excellent singer and it's a great way to start a variety show. There are other times where people are very good playing off other people, so you might have cast members come out and share the burden with them in the monologue. But there are a lot of different ways to skin a cat with a monologue, and sometimes the cat even makes it out alive.
Do you ask if they have any secret gifts like singing or dancing or impressions?
That's one of the first questions you ask. You know, do you sing? Do you dance? Do you do accents? Do you have impressions? And again, that's something that, to some degree, the thing you most and least want to hear from a host is them saying, whatever you want me to do, I'm game. Because that's great, and that implies that they have the right attitude about it, but you also would love sort of 5 specific things that they can do better than someone else. And again, not to go back to someone like Alec Baldwin, but he's the kind of guy who shows up and is like, I think I can do Tony Bennett.
Oh, yes. Which, yeah.
But yeah. That, you know, you don't look at Alec Baldwin and naturally think, oh, perfect. You know, he'll be Tony Bennett. That sort of comes from Alec showing up, knowing how the show works, and suggesting to the writing staff, I think this would be really fun.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Seth Meyers. He's been hosting NBC's Late Night since February, replacing Jimmy Fallon, who is now host of The Tonight Show. Meyers had been with Saturday Night Live since 2001. He became the co-anchor of Weekend Update and also was the show's head writer. 3 years ago, he got great reviews performing at the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
You hosted the White House Correspondents' Dinner, in which the president comes out and makes, you know, does a little stand-up, and then a guest comic performs. And you were really funny. So, like, you're seated at the head table next to Michelle Obama, and I think next to President Obama, too. And then
he was on the other side of the podium. I was next to
her. Oh, okay, so you're just
next
to Michelle.
First lady,
Right, okay. And then, so I want to play something that you said. The dinner was broadcast on C-SPAN.
Yes.
And you made some funny jokes about C-SPAN, and it will soon be clear why we've chosen this clip to play.
I am also honored to be performing for those of you here tonight, as well as the handful of people watching at home on C-SPAN. C-SPAN is, of course, the official network for wide shots of empty chairs. Every time I tune into C-SPAN, it looks like they just had a fire drill. C-SPAN is one unpaid electric bill away from being a radio station. People think Bin Laden is hiding in the Hindu Kush, but did you know that every day from 4 to 5 he hosts a show on C-SPAN?
Okay, great joke about Bin Laden. Little did you know that the next day, U.S. Navy SEALs, with the approval of President Obama, was going to get Bin Laden. So when you found out what was in store the next day, after having made that joke and after having performed with President Obama, what went through your mind?
First of all, you're just blown away because the president was great at the correspondence dinner. He has like a stand-up's rhythm. Even when I watch him give speeches now, I'm like, oh, he has a stand-up's rhythm. So it's one thing that he was, you know, planning this thing that to some degree would, you know, define his presidency in the history books. But the fact that he could be planning that and also go out and just knock it dead at the correspondence dinner. So that made me very jealous because I, of course, it required 110% of my concentration to do the job I did. But it's very funny, and I've talked about this a lot, but the idea of I felt so good about the job I did at the correspondence dinner. And I remember taking the Acela back to New York with my father, and it was Sunday afternoon, and we were sort of sitting around feeling just on cloud nine about how the correspondence – this is a story of hubris. I'm telling a story of hubris. And we were feeling so good. I just remember thinking, like, when the news comes on Monday, all they're going to do – is talk about how funny I was on Saturday night. As long as nothing happens on Sunday, a notoriously slow news day, Monday belongs to Seth Meyers. So it was a really funny thing that I think of everybody in the country upon hearing that Bin Laden had been assassinated. I was the one guy who was like, oh, tonight? They got him tonight?
Well, you know, President Obama was so funny. He must be, like, the worst opening act to follow.
Well, I want to point something out, and I'm pretty sure I'm right about this. I think the presidents used to close. I think the comedian used to go first, and Obama flipped it because he's a genius. But, yeah, it's an impossible opening act to follow. And you shouldn't have to follow the president. The president should always talk last.
I was worried about president. You. No, I was worried. Yeah. I thought, like, oh, my God, that's going to be so hard to follow. But you were great. You were really
Thank
funny.
You. I do remember, because he's also, because here's why he's the worst opening act of all time. He also closes. He doesn't close with a joke. He closes, like, talking about, like, spare a thought for the troops.
Right.
It's all spare a thought for the troops and give it up for your next comedian.
So you're also in the position, hosting the White House Correspondents' Dinner, of making jokes about the president, something you're used to doing from Weekend Update. But this time around, he's sitting right next to the podium as you're making jokes about him. And the First Lady's right there, too. So how did that affect both the material and the delivery?
Well, we approached it, and when I say we, I mean myself and the numerous joke writers that were kind enough to help me out with this process, which we spent about 3 weeks on writing the material for this. We approached it knowing that he has a very good sense of humor, and even if he doesn't, he has a very smart quality, which is he knows that if you tell a joke about him, it's more attractive to laugh at that joke, get caught laughing, than get caught sort of simmering. So we knew if the jokes were sort of good enough and smart enough that we'd probably have him on our side. And it was fun. Also, you know, I think to some degree we realized that lose the president, lose the room, because it is very unique in a performance where it's not just that he's next to you. It's like if it was him in the front row, that's one thing. But him next to you means the entire audience can watch him as well. So to some degree, it might be more interesting to listen to me tell jokes and watch the president than it would be to listen and watch me. I mean,
oh,
that's
no,
certainly
I see
what
your
I
point.
Would do.
Right. Like, how's the president
you know, like,
taking
if you're in the audience, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, let's hear an example of one of your President Obama jokes. So this is coming out of a section in which you were talking about what a weak field of Republican presidential candidates there were. So here's Seth Meyers at the White House Correspondents' Dinner 2 years ago.
So it's not a strong field, and who knows if they can beat you in 2012. But I tell you who could definitely beat you, Mr. President. 2008 Barack Obama. You would have loved him. So charismatic, so charming. Was he a little too idealistic? Maybe. But you would have loved him. I still think we all remember that inauguration day, the First Lady was there. And may I say, for as beautiful as you looked that day, you look even more beautiful tonight. Now you, on the other hand, Mr. President, have aged a little. What happened to you? When you were sworn in, you looked like the guy from the Old Spice commercials. Now you look like Louis Gossett Sr. I've never said this to anyone before, but maybe you should start smoking again. Is this the change you were talking about? Mr. President, look at your hair. If your hair gets any whiter, the Tea Party is going to endorse it.
That's Seth Meyers at the White House Correspondents' Dinner 2 years ago. So you were talking about how you know the audience was watching President Obama's face to see how he was taking the jokes.
Yes.
Were you watching his face, too? I mean, were you kind of picking up the vibe of whether he
was
liking it?
I did look over to him a few times during that and was aware that it was going well. And it's interesting because the section before, where I sort of had a joke about everybody in the GOP field at that time, which I do believe history has borne out that it was a fairly weak field, I found him not enjoying it. Maybe not enjoying it, but not wanting to get caught laughing at it as much.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of ended up making a few on-the-fly cuts during that. And I'm not enjoying this. This seems like piling on to some degree.
What'd you cut? Give us an example.
I can't remember exactly, but I remember, you know, at the time, I believe there were probably 9 candidates in the GOP field, if there was, you know, April of that year. And I just remember to some degree, I was like, okay, so, you know, maybe I'll skip this Herman Cain joke. You know, maybe this is just going to seem a little too easy. Or, you know, this Newt Gingrich joke. The level of difficulty doesn't feel very high, and I feel like that room appreciates level of difficulty. Whereas one of the first things when I accepted to do the Correspondents' Dinner, one of the first things we started writing jokes about was the fact that he looks so much older and how much this job had sort of aged him. So that was something that I couldn't wait to get to. Like, I felt very good about that run of jokes.
So your performance is over. The president gets up, shakes your hand, pats you on the back, and you pat the president on the back.
Yes.
Did you say to yourself, oh, no, I just patted President Obama on the back. Like, you know, attaboy, President Obama.
that whole, like, first 5 minutes after finishing, I sort of like my ears felt the way they do underwater. Like everything was just sort of a weird hum. So I don't remember. People have often said because, and especially, well, you know, after we found out the next day was, you know, the SEAL Team 6 assassination of Osama bin Laden, people would ask me, what did you say to President Obama? And I've always said, I told him, check Abbottabad. I feel like there's a compound in Abbottabad that doesn't smell right to me. But it was great. And I'm not being humble. This is a very genuine thing that I didn't quite – it was very strange, those 20 minutes, which is about how long it is, because it's a very strange room. Like the correspondence dinner room is very wide. People are sitting around tables, so half of the audience is just sort of craning to see you. It's a very uncomfortable room. As a comedy room, it's an F-minus. And the sort of sound goes straight up. So to some degree, I felt like I had done well. But I didn't quite know, to be honest. And like most comedians, I probably walked off thinking about the three or four things that I wish had gone better. And very sweetly, my phone rang like 2 minutes after I finished. And it was Senator Al Franken, who, of course, I'd sort of crossed paths with at SNL and who had been a correspondence dinner host himself in the past. And he was very, very kind. And that was my first sense of, oh, that went really well.
My guest is Seth Meyers, who now hosts Late Night on NBC. He's the former head writer of Saturday Night Live and the former anchor of Weekend Update. So you look like you were almost going to cry on your last night.
Yeah.
anchoring Weekend Update. And I thought I'd play your last words as the anchor of Weekend Update. And this is at the end of a whole bit where people who you've worked with from Saturday Night Live over the years come out. Amy Poehler, Andy Samberg. I think Fred Armisen was there.
Yes, Fred.
Bill Hader.
Fred did his Governor Patterson.
Yeah. And so I don't know if you knew that they were all going to be there or not.
I did. I was aware they were all going to be there. Yes.
Okay. So here's like your last words.
It is my last show, and I just want to say being out here with my co-anchors and my dear friend and my husband is the perfect way to end. This is the job I always wanted, and I had the best time, and I met the best people, and I just want to thank the crew and the cast, and especially the writers and Lauren, and thank you very much. And take us out, Cecily.
For Weekend Update, I'm Cecily Strong.
I'm Amy Poehler.
I'm Stefan Meyers.
And I'm Seth Meyers. Good night.
So, Seth Meyers, what was going through your mind as you said that?
I was a little heartbroken. I really, you know, I'd been there for 12 and a half years, and I feel like I grew up there, and I feel like the people I met there are really, truly my closest friends. And, you know, I got married this past summer, and I think we decided that, like, I think half of the people at our very large wedding were somehow connected to SNL. So it was really sad to think that was the last time I was going to sit behind that desk, because some of the greatest times of my life have been back there. And it was also the fact that Andy and Amy and Fred and Bill had all come back and, you know, had come back at sort of at first mention of the idea that I would like to have them there.
You know, I'm thinking that when you were head writer on Saturday Night Live, you wrote for the guest hosts.
Yes.
And now you're talking to them. You're not writing for them. Which is more fun?
Well, when it goes well, both are really fun. That's been the biggest difference in this job. And the part of the job I was most worried about was, of all the skill sets you develop at SNL, the one you don't really develop is interviewing somebody. You know, people had always said like, oh, you're so good interviewing characters on Weekend Update. And I had to always point out, you know, those are fully scripted. And it doesn't really count as an interview if you know the answer.
No, you really brought out the sensitivity of Stefan.
Yes. No, he really clammed up with other people.
Yeah.
So, but I'm really delighted in interviewing people so far. I'm always surprised at how fast 7 minutes can go if you're talking to an interesting person. It's been a relief, because that was the fear, was sitting out there with someone and feeling like neither they nor you knew what to say next. And that hasn't happened yet. So that's been really fun.
Seth Meyers, it's been great to have you back on Fresh Air. Thank you so much. And I wish you the best of luck with Late Night.
Thank you so much, Terry. It's wonderful to be back.
Seth Meyers spoke with Terry last Wednesday. Meyers is the new host of NBC's Late Night following The Tonight Show. Our next guest is comic Hari Kondabolu. A lot of his comedy is about race and ethnicity. His parents are from India.
I've been traveling all over the world telling jokes. I was doing a show in Denmark last year. I don't know why. Didn't go particularly well. Not really the target demographic for this career. But I got heckled in a way I'd never been heckled before. A man got up in the middle of my show, and he interrupted, and he said, "Hey, go back to America."
Wow.
It's amazing. It's amazing, because I've been told to go back to so many countries. And, never to America. I've been told Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, whatever country we're bombing, I'm told to go back there.
That was Kundabolu performing on John Oliver's New York stand-up show in 2010. Kundabolu was a writer and correspondent on W. Kamau Bell's political comedy series Totally Biased, now on FXX. Bell says Kundabolu is the comedy equivalent of a punk rock concert that breaks out at a human rights rally. Human rights was the direction Kundabolu initially headed in. He worked as an immigrant rights organizer in Seattle while performing stand-up at night, expecting that comedy would remain a sideline. In 2008, he got his M.A. in human rights from the London School of Economics. He was surprised when his stand-up career took off. The title of his new debut album, Waiting for 2042, is a reference to the year the Census Bureau projects that whites will be in the minority in the U.S. Terry spoke with Kundabolu last Monday and began with an excerpt from the track 2042 and the White Minority.
But here's the bigger point. Here's the bigger point, right? 49% white doesn't make you the minority. That's not how math works, right? 49% white is only the minority if you think the other 51% is exactly the same, right? It only works if you think, well, it's 49% white people and 51% you people. That's the only way that works. Because that 51% is not a united front, okay? And it's easy to find out. Just ask a black guy and a Korean guy what happens when the black guy walks into the Korean guy's store, all right? I bet you the interaction might not be pleasant. I bet you it's not going to be like, "Hey, teammate. How's it going, teammate? Pretty excited. You? 2042, am I right?" That's not what's happening. There's some historic tension there. It's not a united front. And some of you might be thinking, well, hurry, you're saying that 51% is not exactly the same, but you're assuming that all white people are the same. Yes. No. No. Of course not. I'm joking, right? Because white isn't a thing. Race isn't a thing, right? It's a social construct. It's a weighted device. It's not real. And we know this. There used to be signs in this country that said no blacks, no Irish, no dogs, right? The Irish weren't white. The Jews weren't white. The Italians weren't white, right? Race is a weighted device. It's not real. And the people of color in this room, you know this, because when you ask your white friends what their cultural heritage is, they don't just say white. They give you a math equation. Right? Well, I'm a third German and a fourth Irish and 1/16th Welsh and 1/40th Native American for college applications. I mean, wow, this works.
Harry Kundabolu, welcome to Fresh Air. So you have your master's in human rights from the London School of Economics. And
yeah, I've wasted a lot of money before I decided to do stand-up full-time, Terry.
Well, I'm sure you've made so much money in stand-up that it well, well
have
made
you heard
up
my
for
act,
it.
Terry? I can play 10 cities.
So you got your MA from the London School of Economics in 2008. And in 2005, you moved to Seattle to be an immigrants' rights organizer. So what was your plan? Like, what did you think you were going to be?
I thought I was going to be a lawyer. I moved to Seattle as part of an AmeriCorps program to work in an immigrant rights organization. I took the LSATs that fall.
That's the legal SATs?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I took it, immediately started doing comedy as soon as I finished the exam and, you know, at night, you know, when I was working during the day. And my plan was to be an immigrant rights organizer and apply to the London School of Economics for this master's program, because at a certain point I realized if the LSAT was that miserable, I think law school would have been worse. So I kind of dropped that, and also talking to lawyers and them telling me, do not be a lawyer. You have such a nice personality. Why would you waste it? Like, hearing things like that repeatedly, it became clear maybe this isn't for me. But I knew, you know, I loved organizing, and, you know, I was working with victims of hate crimes. I was doing some work in detention centers and meeting families whose family members who were going to be deported. And, you know, it was really powerful work. And, you know, that was incredible, but it was incredibly hard. And performing at night was a relief. It was cathartic. It was just a way to get things out. And, you know, comedy was something I always had. Like, I started doing it in high school in Queens. And, you know, I did it through college. And doing it in Seattle was for fun, and I really didn't expect it to be a career because you don't become famous out of Seattle. And, I, you know, I'm from New York. I know, like, the New York scene's harder, and that's where it happens, or in Los Angeles, but it doesn't happen out of Seattle. And I applied to the London School of Economics for this Master's in Human Rights program, and while that happened, I got found by the HBO Comedy Festival, who wanted me to be in their festival, and I auditioned and got a spot, and then I was on Jimmy Kimmel Live shortly after that, which was remarkable because I flew to Los Angeles, stayed in a hotel, you know, a nice hotel, and was on Jimmy Kimmel Live. And I think William Shatner was on that night. It was absurd. And then I flew back to Seattle the next morning and right back to work and organizing. It was a hobby that kind of got away from me. You know, it became a career and I didn't expect it to.
Did those two worlds ever come together? Did any of the immigrants you were working with ever recognize you from, say, Jimmy Kimmel? Or did you ever tell jokes about deportation, which I think is probably unlikely?
I mean, a little bit. I mean, I did talk about immigrant rights, and I talked about immigration and my parents' story and just the ridiculousness of Mexican immigrants being called lazy and stealing all the jobs. Like, how do those two ideas even work together? So I tried to find ways to incorporate a lot of that. I used to do a bit where I used to read the U.S. citizenship application on stage. And I think that's part of just being overeducated and wanting to do document analysis. But I would actually, like, bring it on stage and read questions. And, you know, because for people who don't know, it's like, this is what immigrants have to go through to gain status in this country. And it's absurd. It's something that we take for granted as American citizens. So, you know, sometimes that was hard in a club on a Friday night and it's 10 o'clock and everyone's drunk and there's a dude on stage reading, you know, a form. It's a strange thing to read a government form in front of a bunch of drunk people. But I felt like if enough, which is a lot of like late night comedy shows, but I feel like if I was able to connect with enough people, it was worth doing it.
You'd get more laughs if those forms had breasts on them.
Is that something that okay, I will send that to I'm sure there's a government website I can give feedback. That's a great idea for me and Terry Gross.
So what was funny about the forms, like, that you would read and actually, you know, think was funny?
People, there were questions about, like, whether you were affiliated with a terrorist organization, which is like, why would you even click yes? You know, there's a lot of things that were just relics of another era. And, you know, whether you were ever you know, sex worker. They don't use sex worker, obviously. They use prostitute. But, you know, whatever is in me had me say sex worker right now to you. But because it should be sex worker. I mean, that is the proper term. But, yeah, like, they had questions like that, which I always thought, like, let's say you were somebody who was forced into sex work. That's an awful question to have to address on this form when you're so close to something amazing that gives you so much access and power, you know, American citizenship. So, you know, to me, like, going through these questions with people and kind of making fun of them, like, felt great. And for people in my audience who've gone through that process, it was probably cathartic. And for me, it was cathartic because I'm like, I was thinking about my mom, and my mom's a U.S. citizen, and what her process was like, and the fact that she had to go through this, you know, as an Indian immigrant, you know, applying for citizenship. Like, it was pretty great to be able to do that bit.
Do you ever feel guilty that you're doing stand-up comedy instead of helping immigrants?
A lot. I try to get over it. I have to, because you can't be a part-time organizer. There's no such thing. Even if organizers are paid part-time or not at all, like, they're working full-time. Like, you're supporting your communities. You know, there are a lot of folks who don't even get called organizers. They're just folks in their communities who have full-time jobs and families who are doing this because it helps their community. And they're organizers, too. They just don't get called and they don't get paid for it. And it's a full-time thing. And I felt like, if I did community organizing part-time while doing stand-up, I would be doing both a disservice. I can't. I know I organized the rally, but I can't be there because, you know, I'm going to be on Kimmel. You know, it's a TV spot. I got my tight five ready to be on Kimmel. I can't. What, you expect me to give up Kimmel? Because, you know, that's not how this works. And so I felt like, you know, there was a lot of guilt, but, you know, there's also been a lot of positive feedback and people saying that my work means a lot to them and my comedy is new and they never thought a voice like me would exist in the mainstream. And I'm shocked by it too, to be perfectly honest. And whenever I hear things like that, I'm like, okay, maybe I am doing good. And it's tricky, you know, because like I don't see myself as an activist on stage. I do this because I love comedy, and the points of view that I'm sharing are my points of view. They're like genuine points of view. This is how I feel about the world. I'm being myself. And it's a strange thing because I don't want to go up there and think I have to change the world. Everything I'm saying is going to have this impact, because I think it's very easy for comics to be egomaniacs already, like just by the nature of people are paying attention to us. I didn't want that in my head, but I also knew that the stuff that I was saying was having impact.
So since you got your master's degree in human rights from the London School of Economics, I thought we can hear a bit that you do that's called My English Relationship. Okay. So you want to hear that?
Sure.
When I was living in London, I was dating this English woman. And the first 3 months I was there, it was like really exciting. She was over at my place like 3 nights a week, immediate trust. And then 4 months in, she was over at my place 4 nights a week. And I noticed she was starting to tell me what to do, like when to wake up and when to sleep and what to eat. And I'm like, this is weird. But like early on in a relationship, you have to set boundaries. So maybe this was part of that boundary setting process. I'm like, okay, let's go with this. 5 months in, she's over at my place 5 nights a week, and my brother had come to visit. And I don't know what she said to my brother, but by the end of his week there, he was angry at me. She had, turned my brother against me. It was so strange. And then 6 months in, I hated how I was being treated. I decided to assert myself, and I said, I don't like how I'm being treated. I'm a human being. I deserve more. And that's when the beating started, and I don't know why she felt comfortable hitting me, but she did, and it was terrible. I felt defenseless. I felt like nobody could help. Nobody was listening. And after 7 months, she's over at my place 7 nights a week. She has her own place. She has her own place that she's paying rent for, but she's over at my place every night of the week, eating my food, telling me what to do, hitting me, and that's when I knew this wasn't love. This English woman was trying to colonize me. And I, of course, did what I was trained to do in such situations. Nothing. I simply didn't cooperate. I used nonviolent resistance. And after a month, she finally left. And she took most of my best stuff with her. Food, art, self-esteem, all gone. And she left a few things. She left some clothes and some books. And, of course, an extensive railway system. Yeah. So, for the non-South Asians in the audience, who perhaps didn't understand why there was applause, the British built a really extensive railway system throughout India before they left, and it wasn't so much for transportation for the Indian people. It was because it's really hard, of course, to plunder on foot. And
that's Hari Kondabolu. That's a really funny bit. And
high-end colonialism material.
Exactly. And I think part of the problem of being a comic from a minority group is that you have to explain some of the jokes to audiences that aren't of your group or that never took a history class.
Sure.
And you have to make the explanation funny, like you do about, you know, the extensive railway system.
That's part of my style now at this point, I think.
To explain your jokes?
Yeah, I actually have fun with it. Because they tell you you're never supposed to explain your jokes because, that ruins the joke. And to me, that is the joke. Like, throughout the album, there's a track called Toby where I have to explain a Roots reference.
Exactly, but,
I like explaining the references. I feel like, I don't know, maybe, again, it's me being overeducated, but I do like that. I feel like I'm a cool professor. Maybe I'm not because I just called myself that. But, I find these things funny. And I have to find a way for you to think they're funny. And if I have to explain it so you get what I'm talking about and then laugh at the thing I think is funny, then so be it. It might take an extra minute. It might mean that our attention spans have to go back to 1987. But I think it's possible for us to get through a minute setup to get to something else.
So when a heckler heckles you, what do they usually say? What are the typical insults you get?
It varies. Heckles always vary. I mean, some people are just drunk and it's nonsense, or, you know, some people just want to just repeat something I've said or add their own two cents about an opinion. But because of the nature of what I do and who I am, I also get the racist stuff, which is hard. And the worst stuff actually is not just the racist stuff about being Indian or whatever. It's folks in the front rows who occasionally they don't, you know, it's usually at a comedy club, they don't know what they're coming to. They stumble into my show. They want to sit up front because the worst people always want to sit up front and they want you to talk to them. And even if you make fun of them, they love it. It's awful. And, I've been in situations at clubs enough times where that front row, somebody in the front will start whispering racist things to me or saying something soft. So it's not loud enough where other people would potentially say something to them, but loud enough where I can hear it. And I have to choose at that point, do I stop the show to call somebody out or do I just keep going because everyone else is having a good time? It's such a cruel thing. I hate it. It's like, because you know you're annoyed by my stand-up, you know this is going to hurt me, but at the same time, like, you're too much of a coward to say loud enough where other people might go after you as well.
What was your comedy like when you were in high school? Do you remember any of your really early jokes?
A lot of my early material was Indian-centric stuff, lots of accents. I used accents. I talked about my parents. I mean, it was stuff I'm not proud of, but, you know, if the goal was to make people laugh, and that's all, the only goal I had was to make people laugh. The idea of being true to myself or, I mean, to be fair, like, I didn't really have a self. I was 17, you know,
right.
I had no real firm opinions at that point. So if the goal was to get the high of making people laugh, well, then mission accomplished. You know, I'm still doing it. So
at the risk of embarrassing yourself, would you be willing to share some of that early material?
Oh, Lord. I talk about things my father would say with his accent. And I don't do that anymore, obviously. But at the time, it was like, if it worked, it worked.
Why don't you do that anymore?
First of all, I don't do impressions well. That's not the main reason, but that should be noted to begin with. It's hard having an accent in this country, and you are judged based on it. And I can imagine that it must be hard for my folks to work twice as hard to communicate. And also the idea that when maybe my father says something and he walks away, the idea that people are laughing because what he said is funny to them because of how he sounds crushed me when I thought about it. And the idea that I was contributing to that, it was hard. And I've been saying this on stage, like, my father should be judged based on the content of his words and actions and not the accent that comes with it, because he does a lot of ridiculous things that have nothing to do with his accent. And I think that's, you know, that's kind of how I've been approaching it. Like, they're human beings and they should be viewed as parents and human beings and not just a series of funny sounds.
Hari Kondabolu, thank you so much. It's really been fun.
Oh, it's been great, Terry. Thank you.
Hari Kondabolu spoke with Terry last Monday. His new comedy album is called Waiting for 2042. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Sharrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.